2 Peter chapter 3, look at verses 11 to 13 with me. Let me read them. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. A few weeks ago, I named my message, God's Time and Temp. And you remember, time was his view of time. 1,000 years, day, not a big deal to God. That is not a key to interpreting prophecy, however. Just because it says the day of the Lord doesn't mean it's 1,000 years. And when he says 1,000 years, he doesn't mean it's just going to be a day. And I like to emphasize that. Like I said, Daniel, when he saw that Jeremiah prophesied 70 years, he said, God, 70 years, we're coming up on that. You know, he took it literally and seriously. And of course, the whole issue of working out the 69 sevens, you come down to, there's some disagreement about the exact day, whether it's a triumphal entry or if it is the day of the Passover sacrifice. When you're talking about 490 years, there's a little room for wiggle room there. But anybody who takes it seriously comes down to the Passion Week. I mean, and so you look at those numbers are literal. Why wouldn't we take other things literally? But at the same time, you know, God doesn't view time the same way. And he says, listen, I can do in a day what you would think takes 1,000 years. And if I choose to, I can take 1,000 years to do what you think I ought to do in a day. You got to have a different perspective, because that's my perspective. And then the temp was the idea, not of temperature, but of temperament. The Lord says, if I delay, my temperament is this, it's so people can be saved. It's because I have compassion. And way to go, wife, you did it. She has no idea what she did, but she did it. Okay. This issue of compassion is the only thing that delays in any sense the return of the Lord. It's compassion. And it's a beautiful thing. But now we need to turn around and look at you and me and say, okay, in regard to what Peter's revealed about the future, what should be our sense of time and what should be our temperament in view of that? I think there's three ingredients we need to look at tonight in view of our of time and our resulting temperament in these passages. And I'm going to kind of break the passage up a little differently than the word order here. And the first of these ingredients is this. We live in a time of expected alteration. In the first part of verse 11 and the last part of verse 12, we read, therefore, since all these will be dissolved, you jump down the last part of verse 12, there's a coming day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Expected alter. Do you expect this all to change? are you thinking that way? You know, what the world calls real, we ought to know is deceptive. Very careful, okay, and forgive me if I get too broad and you know, ask me questions, and I'll try to explain as best I can, but you've heard this issue of postmodernism and modernism. Neither one of them is inherently biblical, neither one is inherently evil. Modernism is what came out of really the scientific awakening of the human mind, where he started delving in all these things. And modernism believed that we will, in the modern age, we will explain it all. We'll take it all apart, we'll put it back together, and we'll figure it all out. And so the modernist mind is big on proofs. Okay, we'll prove this, we'll prove that, we'll prove the other thing. And a lot, quite honestly, of our ministry has been built on a modernist mindset, where we go out and say, what we need to do in apologetics is prove this and prove this and prove this. There's only one problem. After you've proved it all, they still don't believe. Everybody ever gone through that? You ever presented a lead pipe argument for exactly what the person asked, and they still won't surrender to Christ? It's not necessarily completely thing, but most of us were raised in a modernist mindset. Give me proofs. Now here's what the postmodernist mindset is. The postmodernist, and I've discussed this with you before, the postmodernist looks at this pulpit and says to the modernist, is that solid? The modernist says, sure it is. You can knock it, you can feel it, you can cut it open, you can see it solid. And the postmodernist says, no, you did all of your research and what you found out is that this is composed of atoms. Atoms are composed of electrons and neutrons and protons, but there's more not there in an atom than there is there in the atom. There is more energy than there is matter, and energy isn't solid. And so the postmodernist says, you know, when you get down to it, when you search things out far enough, you suddenly realize we don't know anything about anything. And so one answer is as good as another, because your proofs are going to get changed tomorrow. Have you ever felt like that? When you read the newspaper, you got this headline, scientists have proved, and the next week it's, no, they started to prove something else, exactly the opposite. The postmodernist says, see, why bother proving in the first place at all? Well, here's why I say neither one of them is biblical. We look at it, and the average person says, what's real? This is real. This is real. This world is real. I say, yeah, but what about after death? Yeah, that's not real. Okay, so what you're telling me is, you know, remember Carl Sagan's line? The cosmos is all there ever was. The cosmos is all there is, and the cosmos is all there will ever be. And I could do it in his deep voice, but I hate it. So anyway, not going to do that. But what does he say about you and me? We're just here for a moment, you know, everything else, eat, drink, be merry. You're just a speck in the cosmos. Now, what does God say? This is all going. And you will still be here. I'll roll the heavens up like a scroll. I'll melt the elements with an intense heat. And after that, we'll have a judgment. And everybody who's ever lived will be there. Some will be redeemed, some will be lost. But that life that you say is irrelevant, is short and simple and everything, because you look at what's sitting around you, that's what lasts. This is not an illusion. It's real. But you're more real than it is. God doesn't love that beam over there, but he loves Denise. God doesn't love the Rocky Mountains, but he loves Dave sitting back in the back row, even if he's sitting in the back row. Now, he has to stretch a little bit, but sorry, I couldn't resist. You see, the average person sees the world as permanent, and they're just transitory, and God says, no. The eternal element here is you, not all this stuff. And so we look at this and say, you know what? We're going to go into this world thinking weird. Because we think all the stuff that everybody really counts on is temporary. And the stuff that people say, oh, that's temporary. No. God says, that's a permanent thing. What the world calls real, we know is deceptive. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, all of them, what do you know for sure? Verse 12, there's a coming day of God. Heavens dissolve, be on fire, elements melt with fervent heat, and God will still be there. And all that God is preserving through that process, what God has planned, we know is certain. Okay, that's got to be our perspective here. That's really, really crucial. When you and I die, how much do we leave behind? Well, everything in this world's goods, right? But that's okay. It's going to be dissolved. What do we get? Absence, body, present with the Lord, eternity, ultimate, you know, it's all we fix. Listen, we should pass this time on earth saying, you see all this? One of these days, it's all gone. You remember Jesus in the temple? See all this? It's going. We've been working on it for 40 years. They worked on it for 20 more. It's all going. You think this is really what it's all about. It's all going. It's all going. Live like that. Live like people who aren't all tied to this. You know, in Proverbs it warns you, what happens to wealth? Wealth sprouts wings and flies away. Don't live like that's really your security. Okay? Forgive me, but if you think that way, you're a bird brain. You put your security in a bird. It's going to sprout wings. It's going to fly away one of these days. Okay, and so we look at this and we start off and he's assuming this. He's saying to them, listen, since these things are going to be dissolved, since they're going to be dissolved, he said it again in verse 12. He said it in verse 7, it's being preserved for the day of judgment and perdition of godly men. He said in verse 10, the heavens will pass away with a great noise. Do you think he's trying to get something across to you? Listen, live in anticipated change. Live in this idea that there's going to be an alteration here. Don't act like this is the whole ball of wax. Where do you think Peter got something like that? Well, you say he walked with Jesus. Yeah, but think about it. Remember when we sang a little earlier? Be still my soul. And we remind ourselves, the winds and waves still know what? The voice of him who ruled them while he walked below. Peter and those guys are in that boat, and they see him calling, and they say, what, where, when is this? And Peter found out that he could walk on water until when? Took his eyes off Jesus. Now, if you're out there in a storm, the waves are breaking over the boat, the wind is blowing, the clouds, the strains are coming down, what's real? What's real? Whatever Jesus says is real. Come on, Peter, let's go for a walk. You know, I don't know how to sugarcoat this for you or to bring it back for you, but the reality is, ladies and gentlemen, we are living in a world that we absolutely believe is going to be completely altered one of these days. And so we look at it and we say, hey, you know, I can take it, I can leave it too. This is not what my life is all about. Or your life. We live in a time of coming alteration. We expect that. Now, because of that, then, we should also live in a time of aspiration. What does that mean? Verse 11, the latter part, to the first part of verse 12, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God? Can I ask you something? What's your aspiration? What are you aspiring to? One of the greatest gifts that Christians bring to the world is what I like to call a holy dissatisfaction, a sanctified dissatisfaction. Everybody in the world is dissatisfied with the way things are. But only Christians have the sanctified dissatisfaction that says, I want to be and to do more. I'm content, but I want to accomplish more. I thank God for how far He's brought me, but I want to be more. What is your personal aspiration? What is our aspiration as a church? What is the aspiration of your family? What do you really want? You see, what he's saying in verse 11 is that the knowledge of prophecy makes character obligatory. I've been trying to build this in as we're going through Matthew 24. Yes, there's all this stuff, the abomination of desolation, there's an end time, I absolutely believe in tribulation, but that's not the major issue here. The major issue here is brought home for us by Peter, what manner of persons ought you to be? The word ought is literally in the Greek a verb that means what kind of person is it necessary to be since these things are true? And the word to be is kind of an unusual word there. It means to, what kind of existence are you supposed to have? This, by the way, when I was first in ministry, you know, when you're young, you come in the ministry and all these people go, what are you talking about? They still do it, I know, but you use current terms. And believe it or not, this is how ancient I am. In the 70s when I started ministry, the word lifestyle was a new word. And I remember using that in church, and I had people come, what do you mean lifestyle? Well, what I mean is exactly the word that Peter used here. Manner of life, the way you live, what kind of lifestyle should you have if everything's going to be dissolved? What difference does that make? And he talks about it in terms of two things. What manner of lifestyle is it necessary for you to have in the context of two things? Holy conduct and godliness. The first one, holy conduct, means a holy lifestyle. How does holiness work out in a temporary world? Well, for one thing, you're going to see wealth differently than your neighbor across the street. You know, Christmas child, food shower, missions, church, all the stuff that we give to. The world looks at us and says, you're nuts. Christians voluntarily do what the world will only do if they're taxed. And they'll vote for the first guy that tells them that they won't tax them like that anymore. And Christians say, no, by free will, of my own choice, I will do this. Why? Because that's the kind of people we ought to be if we understand what's really real and what's really eternal. Because more important than me amassing a whole bunch of land, and I thought it was interesting reading John Adams' biography, that he was taught by his father, the only true wealth is land. A lot of people understand that concept. But the Christian says, no, the only true wealth is what? Souls. And eternal wealth. Because what's going to happen to that land? Remember what we just looked at? All that land is going to dissolve. It changes. When you talk about holy, you're talking about really having a completely distinct perspective and approach to life. 1 Peter 1:15, he had said, as he who has called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Hey, how do we view this material? We view it like a holy God does. God says, don't worry about it. I can melt it. I can make it again. Is that the way we approach it? Oh, no, I'm going to lose. Figure it out. What am I going to lose? Like we were talking about this morning. What am I going to lose for His sake? A holy perspective, distinct. 1 John 2:28, now little children, abide in Him that when He appears we may have confidence and not be ashamed before Him at His coming. How many of you think that being rich will make you confident when He comes? How many think that having a good job will make you confident when He comes? How many think that having a big house will make you confident when He comes? How many of you think that having prestige with men will make you confident when the one who can see your very heart shows up? That isn't what does it? It's a holy life. More important than anything else. You know, years ago, I haven't heard too many of these since then. I told you the story of the man in Iowa that was a Christian, and he worked for a printing company. The printing company got the contract to print a pornographic magazine. And he ran the press. He made a very good living. They brought that out, and he said, I cannot be a part of making this filth. I said, doesn't matter. Your union's got a contract. You've got to do it. You're the press operator. Run the press. He said, no, I won't. They fired him. He went to the EEOC, he did all those things, and he stayed fired. And he said, God has made me His own. And I'm responsible to live a holy life, and I choose to be unemployed rather than to be a part of this. That's the guy I got a handle on this. And he lost at the time what was a very, very good paying job. But it goes into everything. Holiness is saying, listen, a lifestyle that is distinct from the world in every manner because I've got a different perspective on life and what's really important and what really matters. You know, 1 Corinthians 6, Christians are suing each other. Now that's talking about Christians suing each other, okay? That's not talking about calling down authority, okay? It's not saying that if you have to go to court because somebody robbed you at gunpoint, you go to court. That's not a Christian who is robbing you at gunpoint, I hope. Okay? This is talking about Christians trying to get advantage of each other in court. And he says, listen, shouldn't you be more concerned for the reputation of Jesus Christ than a few bucks that you're fighting over there? You should have a holy lifestyle. This is different, and we handle this differently than the world does. And he says also that they're in godliness. Well, way back in chapter 1, remember we were going through the list of things where Brian and Ryan and I and Matt all traded off preaching on those one concept. One of them was add godliness. The best way I think that I can say what godliness means is simply this. That every moment of your life you live as if God were alive. And he was watching. And that he cares. It had the idea of giving the proper place to your God in the Greek culture. If you worshipped Zeus, you lived in such a way that it conformed with what was known of Zeus. And if you worshipped Mars, you probably were kind of an overbearing, warlike kind of person. But whatever it was, you're going through these things. And it means to properly honor your God in every facet of life so that you're consistent in your business world, in your home world, in your personal life, and these kind of things. This is what godliness is. And we look at it and say, why did you do that? Because of who God is. New Testament. Servants, why do you obey your masters? Because you have a master in heaven. Do you see how this carries on? Why do you do everything your hand finds to do mightily? Because you do it as unto the Lord. Why do you do just as good a job for minimum wage as you would for $100 an hour? Because of the Lord, you'll receive the reward, right? There's godliness. That's the concept. And so Peter's saying, listen, everything should change because you understand these things. Now here's what that means that Baptists don't like to hear, is that we ought to crave change. I don't know how churches became known for not changing and thinking that was godliness, because the whole gospel is about change. What you were, you weren't anymore. You aren't anymore. What you're going to be is not what you are today. You're going to change all the way through life. The challenge is that the grace of God makes change possible to be positive. In the world, change is always a downward spiral. And so if you're doing it by your own human effort and appearance and purpose and plan, yes, it's going to be a downward spiral. But listen, I still don't do everything God's way. You don't do everything God's way. We as a church don't do everything God's way. And so we need to expect, because of the reality of sanctification, being a set apart to God, being holy and being like God, we're going to continually look for change. And so in verse 12, he says, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved. If I'm looking for that, what am I saying? God, take it all. It's okay. I want you. Because nothing I got now is going there, is it? Got a very different value system. I want you to come back. Be on the lookout for it. Live prepared for that. Live like it's really going to happen. And not only that, hurry toward it. Hit the finish line leaning forward. Where's the finish line of your life? Well, it's either going to be death or the rapture, right? But wherever it comes, head there. I'm astounded at how many people, it's getting worse, are terrified of getting old. What would you rather do? You see this nutcase in England that molested all these children? Look at him. He's trying to stay a kid. That's sick. You know what? I'm amazed. I'm going to turn 60 this year. That's okay. I'm kind of curious what 60 is like. Kathy's had so much practice, and she can tell me. You knew that was coming, right? Yeah. And I'm interested in 70. I'm interested to see what it's like when Nona finally gets old. I don't know what it's like to be married to an old woman yet. See, I got to score the points whenever I can, But if it 60, 70, why don't we want to get old? Because we lose strength. Okay, what do you lose of God as you get older? You actually usually gain more. Hopefully you know him better. That's the definition of Christian maturity. You know God. And what are we so frustrated about? We got this youth-saturated culture, and that's not knocking kids, but we need to say to them, hey, look, keep going. It's all headed towards a terminal point, and it's a good thing. Keep going. Stop being so everlastingly negative. Hurry toward it. I love a story I just read recently about a couple that had a son named Ben. That when he was very little, he had heard many sermons about the importance of surrendering his life to Christ. He really seemed like somebody really attuned to the heart of God, interested in spiritual things as much as a little kid could be. Selfless, kind, all kinds of good things. But he absolutely refused to give his life to Christ. He'd never explain why, but he just kept saying, no, 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 no. Then one morning, at breakfast, he announced that he was ready to give his life to Christ. Cool. He got up and walked out of the room. So they followed him. What's going on? He goes up to his room. He has a little kitty suitcase. He pulls it out, sticks it on the bed, and starts putting some clothes in it, and zips it shut. He says, okay, I'm ready now. And it finally dawned on him. He thought that the minute that he gave himself to Christ, he went to be with Christ. And he was finally ready to do that. He's finally let go of mom and dad and home and everything else for Christ. Isn't that cool? I love that story. And like, you know, this is morning and evening, tag teaming in the schedule of God. Have you gotten there yet? See, Peter's talking about living with your bags packed, only you can't take anything, so there's no point in packing a bag. But having your life packed with the things that matter for eternity. This is a time of aspiration. God, I want the fullness of Christ. I want to be exactly like Jesus. And I'm not there yet, and I won't be tomorrow, but I'm going to keep heading that place. I have a very clear aspiration of what kind of person I want to be. And when I'm counseling young couples who want to get married, and telling this, you know, I've told you this before, but maybe you can share it with some young people that are idiots. But if you're there at 20, 21, 22 years old, and you're making a commitment to death do us part, and I was asking how long are you going to live, and they all go, I don't know, you know, but they all want to live to be 80 or 90 or 100 or 110. And I said, okay, fine. You want to live to be 80, you're 20 now, you're saying, I want to be with this person for three times as long as I've already been alive. How in the world could you possibly know that the two of you have anything in common 40 years down the road? One way and one way only. That if your commitment is to grow into the image of Jesus Christ, a fixed center point out there, every day that you live, you will come closer together. That's why it's so crucial. And unequally yoked, ladies and gentlemen, is not whether you've prayed a prayer. Unequally yoked is whether or not you have the same aspiration, the same purpose, the same goal. And anything short of that is an unequal yoking. And so Peter says, listen, live in aspiration because of the coming alteration. And therefore, you will then live in a time of anticipation. Look at verse 13. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Because of his promise, looking forward with excitement. Yeah, Lord, time's a good thing. It's on our side because it gets us closest to this new heaven and this new earth. Now, you know, do you understand that righteousness is not possible worldwide right now? Let me give you an illustration. When righteousness rules, you will live in complete conformity to every law. How many would be having a conversation with the Lord right now about how fast you drove here tonight? How many would have an interchange with Christ about the conversation you had with your husband or wife this afternoon? You follow me? It's not yet. But when it comes, you know what you and I are going to be? Completely different. So stop trying to stay the same now. Lord, it's all on the table. I'm looking forward to new heavens and new earth in which righteousness dwells, and I want it to dwell in my heart by faith right now and come out of my life to every relationship that I've got. Because I believe that this is all temporary and it's all going to change. And that's what I want. I am anticipating this greatness when I'll be righteous and so will everyone around me and everything that we do. And there'll be a new heavens, there'll be a new earth and a new experience. Righteousness is home. Ladies and gentlemen, we live in a time where we should be living with an anticipation of a coming alteration, an aspiration to be all that God wants us to be, an anticipation that it's going to be there one of these days. What's your temperament today? What time is it on your clock and your calendar? Just a little closer to eternity, and God's still good. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for your grace and your mercy. I sure need it. Thank you that this isn't all there is. The good days aren't as good as it's going to be. The bad days, they're a blip on the way to no more bad days. Father, the president is saying the best is yet to come after the last 4 years. I certainly hope so. But Father, the reality is, for the Christian, that's absolutely true. Even when everything that we have counted as real, that we set our hearts upon, gets dissolved, the best is yet to come. Help us to live like that, we pray, for your glory and in your name's sake. Amen.